Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Right now, I would like to welcome Michael Jensen. He is with the organization Amigos Bravos. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks a lot, Mary Charlotte.
So you are a Taos-based but statewide organization whose purpose is basically to restore rivers to their pure and flowing natural state that is not that long in our past in memory, but it seems like an awfully long time.
Yeah, we have in our vision statement, we say that, a lifetime ago it was possible to kneel down, in northern New Mexico to, a stream and drink from it. And that's kind of what we would like to see again. I know, that's not possible anymore. I come from California, and I know growing up in the Sierra Nevada, every summer you could do that too when I was growing up, and you can't do that.
For many reasons,
right.
Having to do with giardia and
right.
pollution and
right.
a lot of other things. Well, how do we know here in New Mexico what's in our water, our rivers, our groundwater, and our tap water?
That is an extremely good question, because we rely on official sources for information about what's in our water, like the New Mexico Environment Department that samples all of the rivers and streams in New Mexico on a sort of rotating basis, because they don't have the funds to do it all the time. So every 4 years or so. And they publish a list of what's in the waters, for different parts of the state every year. But, that report might be based on one or two sampling events in one small segment of, say, the Rio Grande. And it's possible to miss a lot, because what we have found, what others have found, is that the more you look, the more you find. And unfortunately, it costs a lot to look. But we've been doing a study down in the ditches and drains in the middle Rio Grande, down in the Albuquerque, Bernalillo area. And, we've found various things, the most surprising being pharmaceuticals in the drains and ditches. Because of the Endangered Species Act, the Surface Water Quality Bureau of the state joined with the EPA to go look also for pharmaceuticals, and they found them in the river everywhere. I mean, not in the river, in the wastewater treatment facility effluents, but that's not something they would normally be doing. They're doing it because the Endangered Species Act, they want to determine if the habitat in the river is good enough for the minnows. I've been participating in stakeholder meetings on new dairy regulations, and the Environment Department here said, every time they say that a dairy operation needs to put in a monitoring well and they start getting data from it, they find stuff. So, the more you look, the more you find. And unfortunately, not very much is being looked at very often. So we don't have nearly as good an idea of what's going on in our waters as we ought to.
Well, Amigos Bravos has been doing some monitoring, and you've found large amounts of Tylenol and steroid hormones, things like that?
Yeah, we have this project. It's funded through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It's part of something called the Middle Rio Grande Bosque Initiative, which is federally funded. And we've been lucky enough to get funding through that for this year, and we got refunded for next year. And what we do is during the irrigation season from the beginning of March until the end of October, we sample three times in March, sometime around June or so, and then late September, early October, to get seasonal variations in flows in the ditches and drains. And we look for all the sorts of things that you would look for in the river. So we look for metals, nutrients like ammonia and phosphorus and nitrogen, E. coli as a marker for other kinds of, fecal-related stuff. And one of the things that we were looking for is pharmaceuticals and personal care products. So we had a list of about 24, and of that 24, we found seven at the farthest site south, which is where the I-25 bridge crosses the East Riverside Drain.
In the Albuquerque area?
In the Albuquerque area, right. And but we also found them up in Algodones, which is north of Bernalillo, which is where the Angostura diversion is, where the river water gets diverted into the East Riverside Drain. We found five of them up there, and we found six at the National Hispanic Cultural Center, which is also on that same East Riverside Drain, about in the middle.
So what pharmaceuticals and personal care products are you finding?
So we found we found acetaminophen, which is in Tylenol. We found carbamazepine.
What's that?
It's an anti-seizure medication. And meprobamate, which is a related chemical, which is used as a tranquilizer. Sulfamethoxazole, which is a sulfa-based antibiotic. Caffeine.
Caffeine.
Yes.
I should hope so.
And a couple of other things, kind of across the range of what we were looking for. And our study, which is in the drains and ditches, corroborates work that was done by a couple of graduate students at UNM, one in the Water Resources Management Program and one in the Biology Department, who also studied the river in various ways, and they found them associated with the wastewater treatment plant in the Albuquerque area, what's now called the Southside Water Reclamation Plant. And but one of those students, Maceo Martinet, who's in the biology department, looked not just in the river but in the shallow groundwater, just off of the river, and he found them in the shallow groundwater as well. So, you know, those students' research, our study, and some recent work in the Endangered Species Act collaborative program have documented pretty conclusively that pharmaceuticals are all over the river, in the shallow groundwater, in the drains and ditches, which are connected to the river through the shallow groundwater.
They go through the process of being turned into tap water? I mean, are we drinking these things in trace amounts?
Well, you know, that's the sort of big question. The Albuquerque Bernalillo County Water Utility Authority, which runs the drinking water project, the San Juan Chama Drinking Water Project, that went online at the end of 2008. And I started talking to them about pharmaceuticals, 3 years ago. And they told me then and other times, and they've said in public, that pharmaceuticals aren't in the river, that they've analyzed the river from, Heron Reservoir to, Elephant Butte, and they've never found them. And that even if they were in the river, that the waste, the treatment process would take care of them. So, in the face of our findings, this year in the drains and ditches and some other work, it wasn't really possible for them to make that argument anymore. And they had a press conference in September saying that they were going to start educating people about how to dispose of pharmaceuticals so they would have less chance of getting into the water, and that they would start monitoring the river in cooperation with the U.S. Geologic Survey. They would monitor the river water at the intake to the drinking water project, the treated drinking water, just as it's getting ready to go into the system, and then the intake and the discharge from the water treatment facility. They would do that quarterly. And we've had discussions with the U.S. Geologic Survey about our project. They actually came out in October and sort of tagged along with us at the sites where we do the sampling, and they collected their own samples. They'll send them to their lab. And they acknowledged that their lab doesn't have the capacity to analyze to the level that the lab that we use, which is out of state in Washington, can do. They're going to switch over to that method sometime next year.
Interesting.
So
The devil is in the details.
Oh, yeah. It really matters, what method you use and what, instrumentation you have, how capable it is of getting down to those really minute levels for pharmaceuticals, we're talking about nanograms per liter, which is,
it's a very small amount.
It's an extremely small amount, but it's been documented. Well, I'll get to the water question, the drinking water question. I'll finish that and then come back to, you know, what it all means. Basically, now the Water Utility Authority will test all of these sources to see if they also find these pharmaceuticals and how well the different treatment processes, the one for the drinking water and the one for the wastewater treatment, how well they work. But at their press conference, they acknowledged that treatment processes don't get rid of all pharmaceuticals. What they use for the drinking water treatment is pretty good, but the EPA itself says that there are no treatment methods out there that will get rid of all pharmaceuticals that are potentially in the water. And it depends on which ones they are. Some are easier to get rid of than others. Sulfamethoxazole, which we found, that antibiotic, that sulfa-based antibiotic, that's one of the ones that seems to be pretty robust and just hang out in the environment a lot. DEET, which is an insect repellent, which is another thing that we found, is something that Maceo Martinet, that biology graduate student, found in the shallow groundwater. So he thinks that it accumulates in the environment as it gets out there.
Well, some things like that are going to break down into something else,
right?
And some things are going to accumulate,
right? And that breaking down is another question. Some of the treatment processes that the research don't know exactly what happens, but they believe that some of those pharmaceuticals break down into other products, and then people don't really know exactly what's going on with those either. Now,
it's not that they're by definition benign,
right? But people don't know, and it's been very well documented now, I think, that in the aquatic environment, for some fish, for amphibians, some kinds of zooplankton, things like that, that at these really minute levels, these nanogram per liter levels, there are impacts to aquatic life. Male fish who are what are called intersexed. They're male fish, but they have eggs, for example. Male frogs that switch over to being female and things like that. Those are impacts from hormones that are in the water. Now, we tested for a few of those, and we didn't find them in March. In the March results that we got, we're still waiting for the June and October results.
I've read studies where they do find them in other places.
Well, they find them all over the place. These studies have been done looking at pharmaceuticals since the 80s in Europe and in the United States. And it's one of those questions. The more you look, the more you find. And now that it's become an issue, different states have set up programs, different municipalities have started testing for them more. There was a study done by the Associated Press earlier this year where they talked to 68 large municipalities across the country, and first they asked them if they tested, and a lot of them didn't test at all for pharmaceuticals yet. Among the ones who did, some only tested for a few, some tested for a lot. Almost all of them that tested found them. Some of them only found one or two. Philadelphia, I think, was the leader. They found something like 56 different pharmaceuticals in their drinking water. And that report and other things that have come out recently have really grabbed the attention of drinking water suppliers. They don't like to talk about it because they know that people will get really upset. Treatment methods aren't there that can get rid of all of these things completely. And also the science on what the impact of human beings is up in the air. I mean, we can't just start dosing, humans with, pharmaceuticals and see what happens. I mean, in a controlled way. But in laboratory experiments on human tissues with, individual pharmaceuticals or combinations of them, and also in some cases combinations of other kinds of contaminants, they see impacts, you know, where human cancer cells start growing much faster, or embryonic tissues have retarded growth, you know, things like that. So
even at these very low levels?
Even at the levels that you typically would find these in the environment. And so it's easy now still to find scientists who will say that there's not an impact, the levels are too low, and so on. But I think the trend now is that among a lot of scientists who are looking at this question is that we really need to dedicate a lot of research at this question. What are the pharmaceuticals, and especially maybe at endocrine disrupting compounds, these hormones, actual hormones that get into the water from birth control pills or estrogen replacement therapy, hormone replacement therapy, people taking steroids, things like that, but also certain kinds of plastics that the body gets in and that mimic the way hormones work,
right.
Like bisphenol A, which got a lot of attention in the last year or so. This sort of class of endocrine disrupting compounds that clearly has an impact on aquatic life, may be one of those groups of pharmaceuticals. I mean, there's hundreds and thousands of these things. Maybe one of those sort of classes that people need to spend the most time looking at. But there's been research done on a lot of these things, I mean, recently, that on a lot of these chemicals, that pharmaceuticals that have been found most commonly, like DEET, which seems to have an impact. It's an insect repellent, so it seems to have an impact on some aquatic life naturally, but also some fish, cold water fish, apparently, in some studies, like salmon and trout and things like that.
For example, let's stay with that for a second. If you have an insect repellent, I know DEET, it's a very good insect repellent.
Right.
It's what you take when you go to places where there's malaria, and it works.
Right.
So it goes into the streams, and then insects might die of eating it, and then the other animals that eat insects don't have their food supply. Is that chain reactions like that?
No, what I've seen is that it also seems to have a direct impact on some fish as well, not because they can't. Get adequate food or something, but something in the nature of the chemical acts directly on them. It doesn't kill them, but it seems to have some impact. But that's one of those ones that's not so clear-cut as, for example, the impact of hormones and hormone-like things. Oxybenzone, that's another thing that we found. It's the chemical that's in a lot of sunscreen lotions. There's emerging research on that one as well. In Europe, they already require labeling of sunscreens if the level of oxybenzone in them is above a very small amount, much smaller than what is typically found in sunscreens here. And because, those sunscreen chemicals are meant to work when they get hit by light, they're photoreactive, oxybenzone is related to another group of benzene photoreactive chemicals that have been implicated in causing cancer. And so there's some concern, that's why there's labeling in Europe now, that oxybenzone, because of its relationship to a class of chemicals that have already been documented that way, may also be a photoreactive carcinogen. So the Center for Disease Control has said that they think that more research should be devoted to looking at that, for example, because it's found all over the place.
So with the example of the sunscreen, you put sunscreen on your body, you spend the day outdoors, there's still some on your skin, you wash it off in the shower,
right.
It goes down into,
right.
then it's in
right.
The...
These things, for things that you put on your body, like DEET or oxybenzone or cosmetics, a lot of the cosmetics these days have sunscreens in them, you wash them off and they go down the drain and through the treatment process, or into your septic system, or whatever. Medications that you take, typically medications aren't completely used up by the body. And for things like antibiotics and and those kinds of things. You're told to take them for 7 days or 10 days or whatever, even though you're probably well, you know, earlier. They just want to make sure. It's a way to not build up resistance, for example.
Right.
And so your body just, you know, excretes all the stuff that you don't use, you know, when you go to the bathroom. So that also gets its way into wastewater treatment facilities or, you know, centralized ones or into septic tanks that leak. So they get into the environment that way.
So there's two... We're talking to Michael Jensen from Amigos Bravos. So in terms of the water issue with all of these pharmaceuticals and personal care products in the water, there's two major things to look at. One is the effects on human health, and the other is the effect on the ecosystem, especially
right.
the aquatic ecosystem. And neither of those is particularly well known.
Right. The aquatic one is much better known because people first started finding these, you know, in rivers and streams and looking at what happened. I mean, they found, you know, aberrations in fish and amphibians and things like that and started trying to figure out what was going on. So that's much better known. The problem with humans is that the impacts could be much subtler to see because pharmaceuticals could be causing outcomes in humans that, you know, are things that we see all the time anyway. I mean, there's one researcher, for example, who, based on some, you know, initial research that he's started, believes that perhaps chronic low doses of pharmaceuticals, like you would get in, you know, taking it in drinking water every day, all the time, could cause, immune system reactions in the body and trigger, autoimmune kinds of diseases like asthma and related ones. Now, people aren't going to connect drinking water to causing asthma because asthma is a reaction to air. So people typically, when they look at asthma, they're going to look at particulates in the air around you or, you know, allergens that you might be getting from, you know, mites in the house or things like that.
Of which there are plenty.
Right. So he speculates that perhaps these chemicals work to just create an overactive autoimmune reaction in the body that then seeks out a pathway that maybe the person has a predilection for. Maybe they have an existing condition that's kind of underlying that gets triggered or something like that. So, but, you know, this is all emerging science. I mean, they've only been really looking at these for 20 years or so, and they've only realized how widespread the problem is for, you know, 10 years or so. And, you know, so the science all has to catch up. There are some people out there who, you know, recommend that, you know, perhaps people with, pregnant women or women who are nursing or people who are already sick, especially people with chronic illnesses or the very young, the elderly, that if there are concerns, if they're worried about it, they should, you know, drink, you know, purified water, something that's going to have all of these things taken out, at least while they're nursing, for example, or whatever.
It's tricky business because we're told not to drink bottled water
right.
because of the problem of plastic bottles.
Right, right. So, you know, it's it's hard to say what to do. Now, what's really good is that all of this attention to the issue has gotten municipalities to start testing more. And it's gotten the EPA and other agencies to start looking at treatment processes that might work. And it's not just the governments. I mean, there's a lot of, university-based or, other kinds of research being done on treatment processes here and in Europe. And, they're sort of tinkering with systems and they're starting to get a handle on what works and what doesn't work and how to make it work better to get rid of as many of these kinds of things as possible or the ones that show up more. So what's really good is that we'll have data from the Water Utility Authority, for example, in Albuquerque for the next year or two to see exactly, you know, what they find, how well the treatment process works, and you know, we can go from there. It'd be nice if, you know, Santa Fe, you know, other places, you know, could do the same thing.
Well, it's, I think, one of the interesting things about having you on the air here, you're from this organization, Amigos Bravos, and you proactively do this kind of testing and monitoring and so on, and that creates a response in actual government agencies to do more, or water utilities to do more than they would otherwise be
right.
doing. So you're really a kind of...
Poking them.
You're poking them. It's very tricky, too, because, I mean, it's one thing... There are certainly many things that we can do. We can, for example, eat organic food so as not to proliferate pesticides, and we can not use plastic bottles, and there's all sorts of things that people talk about continually, but not taking your medicine is
right.
not on anybody's list of things
no,
to do.
No, it's not. Absolutely not. If you need to take medicine, you need to take it, and you need to take it the way it's prescribed to you. And
yeah.
all that sort of stuff. The issue then is, you know, we know that these things are going to get into the waste stream. We just need to figure out ways to get rid of them.
To really treat it.
Or at least to identify the ones that are problematic and focus our attention on them, and which is already being done. But, you know, it's going to take a long time to figure this stuff out.
What is the role of the Clean Water Act in New Mexico?
When the Clean Water Act was passed, well, the Clean Water Act was passed because, you know, rivers were catching on fire, and, you know, Lake Erie was a dead lake, and, you know, we just had a horrendous situation here, and other, I mean, it wasn't just here, in other industrial countries, you know, but here, and it was a combination of... local sort of citizen action, just people finally getting really pissed off with the fact that, you know, a river going through their town would just burst into flames.
Because it had so much,
much you know,
solvent
and,
on the
yeah,
surface.
Oils and stuff like that in it. And, or, you know, a toxic sort of soup of chemicals that would spontaneously ignite. It's just mind-boggling to think about that things could get that bad, but there was no federal regulation on this. And so because people started getting upset and pushing on Congress, the Congress passed and overrode a veto by Nixon to get the Clean Water Act passed.
Nice.
And until 2001, there was a lot of decisions made, you know, was implemented, you know, across the states and at the federal level. There were a lot of court cases, a lot of precedent built, and people thought they had a really good idea about what the Clean Water Act covered. You know, it covered our waters. I mean, people would just assume that their local waters were protected by the Clean Water Act.
Rivers and streams and lakes.
Right. And I mean, it hadn't done, the Clean Water Act hadn't done what Congress originally wanted it to do, which was, you know, clean up our, you know, rivers and streams in a decade or so. But we had made huge progress. The Lake Erie came back, rivers got cleaned up, and then in 2001 there was a decision around a couple of wetlands. And the Supreme Court made the sort of first crack in what the Clean Water Act could cover. And then in 2006, there were a couple more decisions, cases that were collapsed into one called the Rapanos decision. And the Supreme Court, it was kind of a non-ruling. It was a 4-4-1 decision. There were four justices who said the Clean Water Act should continued to be interpreted the way it had been since its inception,
which is pretty strongly
cover
protecting.
All, you know, cover, you know, the waters of the United States. There were four justices who said that this term navigable waters of the United States should mean exactly what the word navigation, navigable, means, even though the way Congress had intended and courts had interpreted, they focused more on the term waters of the United States, not navigable.
So if you can't get your canoe down it, then it suddenly didn't apply anymore?
Well, I mean, navigable would actually mean that you could get a ship up it. So you're talking about coastal waters and, you know, coastal estuaries and, you know, large rivers like the Mississippi and, you know, stuff like that that you can go up for a while. But in New Mexico, you know, maybe Elephant Butte is navigable, but, you know, there's no other water in the state that's navigable.
So the Rio Grande wouldn't even count.
Yeah, but nobody's really would be willing to go there. But about 94% of the stream miles in New Mexico are ephemeral, which means they just respond to seasonal rainfall or, I mean, not seasonal, to immediate sort of rainfall or snowmelt, and or they're intermittent, which means they're sort of seasonal. They flow for part of the year or different parts of the year, but then they don't flow continuously. And so all of those waters, plus Playa Lakes, which, you know, just fill up seasonally, or closed basins, which by definition aren't connected to anything, of which there are a lot in New Mexico. About 20% of the land area in New Mexico is made up of closed basins. So none of those waters, those ephemeral, intermittent, most of the water in New Mexico, you know, is probably not protected by the Clean Water Act if people wanted to make a big deal about it.
So what happened? In other words,
well,
that 441.
Well, the one was another justice who also thought it should be severely cut back and just said that, in his opinion, it had to be navigable, or there had to be a significant nexus, you know, some connection to a navigable water, which was kind of an out. And basically what that meant was that everybody, environmentalists, the you know, regulated community, you know, mining companies and chemical companies, I mean, all those, construction industry, dairy, whatever, nobody knew what was going to happen. And the Bush administration ordered the Army Corps and EPA to come up with what are called administrative guidance, or their interpretation of how they'll carry out this decision. And what happened is that those agencies that are responsible for carrying out the Clean Water Act said that before they can issue a permit, they first have to determine if the water is something that they have jurisdiction over. And we have found by, you know, since 2006 or 2007 when the guidance came out, that there have been a number of what are called non-jurisdictional decisions made just in New Mexico. Maybe the first or the one that got the most attention was in Clovis around the Air Force Base there, where there was some concerns that activities there needed to get permitted, and the Army Corps said, nope, that's non-jurisdictional, we can't require a permit. So they can go ahead with their activity. So that's one effect now of
meaning,
what's going on.
Meaning anybody can do anything in...
They can go ahead on their activities, and they don't have to get a permit. There won't be conditions put on what it is that they do. People at least are aware of what's going on, so they can pay attention, and if they find something that's problematic, they can report it and maybe try to get things changed. But there isn't a permit in place that you can say, hey, they're violating the terms of their permit, you know, whatever. So it makes it much, much harder. And even worse, I've been at meetings. Rachel Kahn, who's our Clean Water Act policy and legal analyst, has been at meetings, and we've heard from other people here and across the country that people in the regulated community are just going, well, hey, we don't even need to ask for a permit, you know, because we think that these waters aren't, you know, applicable. It could be an arroyo running past a construction site, and they'll just go, well, I mean, it's dry now. I mean, we don't even need to ask for a permit.
And so, right, so they just do what they want. If anybody asks them questions later, then they deal with it.
You may not even know where they're doing it.
Right.
You know, I mean, in an urban area, it's hard to hide those, but in rural parts of the state or the country, people can do things where, you know, it might take a long time to figure out there's some activity going on that might be having an impact, and by then it could be too late.
We're talking to Michael Jensen from Amigos Bravos. So where do we stand now with the Clean Water Act in New Mexico?
Well, back, you know, in 2005, the state of New Mexico and, you know, Amigos Bravos and others started to realize that they're, you know, because of that 2001 decision and sort of pressure being put on the system, you know, because of, you know, the Bush administration's attitude towards the Clean Water Act and towards regulation in general, that something needed to be done to protect waters here in New Mexico. And so we worked very closely, we and our allies worked very closely with the Environment Department here to petition in the last triennial review. Under the Clean Water Act, states have to review their water quality standards every 3 years. We're in the middle of one right now. So in the one before this one, we got wording put in there that expanded the definition of waters of the state of New Mexico to pretty much include all of the waters in the state.
On a state level.
At the state level. Under the Clean Water Act, states are allowed to set standards that are more stringent than the federal standards. They can't go below federal standards, but they can set ones that are more stringent. And that language of waters of the state met with huge, huge pushback from the regulated community. Change came just before the legislative session in 2005, and there was just attempt after attempt after attempt to get that overturned in the legislature, and it came down to multiple tied votes in committees in both the House and the Senate in the state legislature, and it just barely, you know, hung on, and the industries, cattle and home building and mining and so on.
Which is what you mean when you say the regulated community.
The regulated community. Yeah. The ones who have to abide, supposedly ought to abide by regulations for what they do. Immediately went to court. And the New Mexico Court of Appeals sided with us and the state. And not just sided with us. I mean, they severely chastised industry and said if things were done in New Mexico where our waters are fragile and we have to protect them, it's an arid climate, if things were done the way industry wanted, we would be in serious trouble. I mean, they slapped them.
And so now,
So they go back to the legislature now every year and they try to pass constitutional amendments to restrict the ability of the executive branch agencies to regulate. They try to take attorneys away. They try to cut budgets. They try to mandate, you know, legislative micromanaging. And it's just getting harder and harder every year. It takes a huge amount of energy on the part of organizations like us, of people in the legislature who want to understand that we need regulations. And, you know, we're looking at it again this year, too. So, you know, it's a mixed bag. I mean, we have, in general, a good situation here, and there are some people in some agencies who are really working hard to make sure that things are done the way they ought to be done. But there's just this huge push to gut the regulatory capacity of the state. And it's really bad. So we're hoping that, you know, the Congress will pass what's called the Clean Water Restoration Act. You know, there was an attempt last year and it didn't go anywhere under the Bush administration because everybody knew he would veto it anyway. There's an attempt again this year. There have been meetings in a House committee and a Senate committee already. It's slowly moving, but there's so much other stuff going on. You know, it may not go through this year, but we're optimistic that a Democratic House and a fairly good Senate can get something through, and then Obama will sign it. And what the Clean Water Restoration Act would do is say, hey, look, for, you know, 35 years plus, people had this understanding of the Clean Water Act, that it covered the waters of the United States, and it would basically get rid of that term navigable and instead put in a paragraph that says these are the waters that are covered. You know, intermittent streams, playa lakes, prairie potholes, all those things that have been sort of stripped out from that court decision.
We're talking to Michael Jensen from Amigos Bravos. So part of your work is to hold polluters accountable in the state of New Mexico. And
yes.
Not only this, but we also want to talk for a little bit about climate change.
Yes. We work inside the state of New Mexico trying to get better policies and regulations in place. We also work a lot at the regional level. We work in collaboration with other state or regional groups and national groups on these issues. So some of the things that we've been successful at have actually involved other groups and making sure that regulations are in place that will really help create a more level playing field between the environment and, you know, polluting industries.
There's regulation, but then there's enforcement. So
yes.
People, whether it be mining companies or livestock or whatever, or are putting stuff into the ground or into the water that is bad for people and bad
right.
for animals. And then you have to, what do you do?
Right. Well, because of the situation that I was talking about before, about non-jurisdictional waters, where there aren't permits issued and things like that, we are working on a citizen's guide to non-jurisdictional waters and explaining to people what those are and how they can go about as an individual citizen or a small community group and go out and like look for things that they think might be problems, and then how to go find out if a permit was ever applied for, what the relevant agency decided about whether it's jurisdictional or not, how to document problems, you know, taking photos, what things to look for, then how to go back to those agencies and have them look into it and that sort of thing. So we're really trying to build the basis for citizen enforcement.
Now, have you done that and have citizens done that where it's successful?
Well, we're trying to formalize something that has been going on for a long time with us and we know with other groups, but we get calls all the time from people who are out driving around. And one example would be somebody was driving up along the road up to the Towski area, for example, and saw, you know, piles of material that had been cleaned off, you know, from the road scrape and stuff like that, pushed off to the side of the road and was going down into the stream. And they called us and said, what do we do? And so we told them how to respond, and we also started making calls, and we got the, you know, relevant agency involved, who went and talked to the folks at the Towski Valley, who agreed, one, not to dump stuff there anymore, to move the stuff that was there to some other location and take care of the problem. And so that's the kind of thing that we're talking about.
But then there's uranium mining and other kinds of mining.
There's all sorts of stuff going on. When prices were really high a couple of years ago for uranium, there was this huge push all across the West and other places, but especially in the West, to get permits issued for exploratory drilling and new mining and milling activity. And out of that actually has come a lot of community resistance. So there's an organization of which we're a part called the Multicultural Alliance for a Safe Environment that's made up of a core of five community groups, you know, so mining impacted community groups out in the Grants Milan area, some native, some non-native, and then a bunch of other organizations that sort of act to provide assistance, you know, technical assistance and support in other ways. And they've pushed back a lot on that, going to hearings, pushing on against bad legislation in the legislature and trying to get good legislation passed to come out and actually do some monitoring, get a better idea of what's going on with people's health and with the environment because of uranium mining, for example. It has, in some ways, you know, become a really nasty fight, and it's unfortunate that it has to be that way, because most of the environmental groups that we know of, and ourselves included, understand really well the need that people have for jobs, especially in a state like New Mexico, which is, has a lot of rural areas that are dependent on, historically have been dependent on mining, for example, or on cattle or whatever. But, where we have a sort of more holistic picture, we can see that the environment is important for rural communities to thrive. They need clean water, to drink. They need clean water to support wildlife that brings tourist dollars in. And there can be a place for these other activities. The other side, all they see or seem to be capable of seeing is how can we get away with the most possible discharges or, whatever, the least amount of regulation, and anybody who's confronting us, gets treated as the enemy.
Right. So you can't, there's no rational dialogue or give and
take.
It's
extremely hard. We've spent several years trying to get dialogue, with different communities on the Clean Water Restoration Act, and we get stonewalled all the time with, really irrational comments. Oh, the Clean Water Restoration Act is going to impact people's, bird ponds in their backyards. I mean, that's the level of the dialogue. It's like what's going on with healthcare reform or the energy and climate bill. There's all of this completely irrational stuff out there that you just waste a huge amount of time trying to argue against. And in the end, the people making those arguments won't talk to you. They just won't listen.
We just have a couple of minutes left, and I want to give you the opportunity to talk about something which is really beautiful that I saw on your website, which is the reintroduction of river otters into New Mexican rivers.
That is really, really amazing. It's a culmination of at least 8 years of work by us and a collaboration of other organizations to document the fact that they really aren't here, which everybody knew, but we had to document, and then identify the best habitats to put them back in, get permission from the state.
If they weren't here, where'd you get them?
We've looked all over the place, but they've come last year and this year from the Northwest.
Uh-huh.
People have gone out and trapped otters in other places, and then, we've built the transportation cages and all that sort of stuff, and, we've gotten, people who've flown them back for us, and volunteers to help release them, and then we'll be monitoring their activities with a lot of volunteer monitoring activity. And right now we're focused on the upper Rio Grande, but if things work out and we deal with some complex issues down in the Gila, then we'd also like to start an introduction program down in the upper Gila as well. There's some concerns that maybe the species that used to be there is different from the one that we're introducing here, and they want to work that out, for example. And there's some other issues with, water resources in the Gila that are much too complex to talk about now. But it's truly exciting.
And it's part of a much bigger reintroduction of native species and getting rid of non-native species program that you're involved in.
Right. We've been working on native species issues up in the Taos area for a long time. And it's also, it's a big problem along a lot of waterways in the state because invasive species generally use a lot more water. They literally suck the water out of streams and rivers. There are story after story where groups, the Santo Domingo Pueblo, for example, or folks out in the mountain air area, they've gotten rid of invasive species, and springs that haven't run for years are now running year-round. It's really, it's just amazing to see things like that happen.
Michael Jensen is with Amigos Bravos, a wonderful organization based in Taos but working statewide. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe. And if people want to get in touch with you, it's amigosbravos.org.
Right. All one word. Or they can call the Taos office at 575-758-3874.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. You can find us on the web at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features a tribute to Louis Prima and Keeley Smith and an hour of Keith Jarrett.